I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
And what I've realized through listening sessions, focus groups, and one-on-one conversations with members of Gen Z is that there really has been a split in how younger Gen Z and older Gen Z sees the world. And the dividing force, I believe, was the COVID-19 pandemic.
On today's episode, I'm talking to one of my closest friends, Rachel Janfaza. She is the authoritative voice when it comes to Gen Z and politics. We talk about everything from her theory on Gen Z 1.0 and Gen Z 2.0, COVID being the dividing line between them. We talk about Gen Z's rightward shift and how Gen Z has become an anti-authoritarian generation, a generation who is influenced by podcasters and the manosphere. And we also talk about what makes politicians relatable to Gen Z, that authenticity and that relatability, and what Kamala could have done when it comes to appearing on more podcasts in the 2024 election. It's a really fun conversation, and I can't wait for you to listen. So you just wrote this amazing piece in the Washington Post about Gen Z 1.0 and Gen Z 2.0. Tell me about it.
So Gen Z 1.0 and Gen Z 2.0 is a theory that I've discovered over the course of the past really 5 years since I've been covering youth political culture. And what I've realized through listening sessions, focus groups, and one-on-one conversations with members of Gen Z is that there really has been a split in how younger Gen Z and older Gen Z sees the world. And the dividing force, I believe, was the COVID-19 pandemic. So the way that I break this up is that for those of us who are on the oldest cusp of Gen Z, and I'm included in that, you are as well, that would be, you know, folks who had graduated college had graduated high school before the pandemic and were already living their lives as young adults, had a taste of independence prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Whereas Gen Z 2.0 is people who were still in school, whether that was middle school or high school or even elementary school, really, during the pandemic. They were the ones who were forced to have remote learning, distance learning for some more than a year, but for most, you know, at least many months. And that really changed how they view the world and how they view authority as well, which is a really important context.
And so when did this idea first click for you?
So I've been holding these listening sessions with young people across the country for the past 2.5 years. And I started to see these divides playing out in my conversations when I would talk to people who were on the older cusp of Gen Z and the younger cusp of Gen Z. It came through the strongest in conversations with high schoolers. So I would say people who were in high school between 2022 and 2024, 2025 now, they have a very different outlook than the people who are on the older cusp of Gen Z, who maybe are entering the workforce now or are young adults in their early careers. And I really started to see this playing out on high school campuses, especially. And a lot of it came down to the way that these high school students or, you know, people who were in middle school during the pandemic would talk about the way that these lockdowns and the way that being in social distance learning had changed their perspective and the way that they therefore resented authority a lot of times as a result because of what they perceived was sort of a fumbling of social distance learning during the pandemic.
And I think when, you know, we talk about Gen Z, we often associate Gen Z with progressive causes. There was a rightward shift, though, in the 2024 election. Can you talk about the way that politics is changing amongst Gen Z?
Yeah, so this is a part of the theory of the Gen Z 1.0 and 2.0, where for Gen Z 1.0, you know, this is a generation that when Gen Z was first eligible to vote, our generation was leaning far to the left. We were responsible in large parts, applauded for helping to put President Joe Biden over the finish line in 2020, and certainly in the 2018 midterms when there was record high youth voter turnout, a large part of that was because of this activism after the tragic school shooting in Parkland, Florida, and then the March for Our Lives. And so the early cusp of Gen Z was really seen as this progressive, socially minded, activist-driven generation. We were the ones who were leading marches for gun safety, for climate action, racial justice, women's movement, and women's marches. And then there was a shift in how activism was being perceived, but also the types of movements that young people were leading. And you know, when you look at the results of the 2024 election, there's obviously been so much talk about young people's movement to the right, especially young men. And there is a gender gap at play here that we could get into. But I believe, and what I've heard through my conversations with young people, is that the anti-authority sentiment that resulted in part because of the way that the pandemic was handled, especially when it comes to learning and some of the protocols associated with that, there was, you know, if you look at who were the ones who were in charge during that time when young people were not having their normal college or high school graduations, were not having their normal life experience of the big football game or prom or any of these huge life moments for a young adult, but also, you know, even the small interactions, like just the ability to flirt with your, you know, the ability to go to a regular sporting game, that really frustrated young people at a critical time in their adolescence. And as a result, I believe they looked at who was in charge during that point in time. A lot of the social distancing measures and COVID protocols were put in place by Democrats, and those policies were perceived as left-leaning policies. And so if you are going to be angry at someone over those policies and over the impact that it had on your lives, the fact that you weren't allowed to, you know, be around your friends when you wanted to be, and sort of the lack of freedom that came from that, the people in charge were Democrats. And therefore, I think young people have started to perceive Democrats as, you know, the ones who are responsible for curtailing that freedom, and then move to the right as a result.
And are younger people more open-minded about politics? I think there was a culture for a long time around fear of speaking out about what people truly believed. If there is this rightward shift, are people open about it, or it's more of a private shift?
There's been a huge shift in terms of the acceptance of being a young conservative. So something that I've heard from a lot of young students in particular across the country is that they have noticed a shift on their own campuses around perception of young Republicans. So, for example, I spoke with a young man over the summer. It was actually while I was at the Republican National Convention. And he told me that when he was in high school, he's from California, he was always conservative. And he would be outspoken as a conservative in high school. And people would ostracize him. They would say, you know, are you crazy? You can't believe you support that. things along those lines. Even when he first got to college, he's now a student at the University of Chicago, he said that same logic was in place where he felt he was oftentimes cast aside for having these conservative beliefs. But then he noticed a change in the way that people were perceiving him, I would say really in the past year to year and a half, 2 years, and it was no longer deemed unacceptable to be a campus conservative. And that's one story, but I've heard that time and time and time again. And we certainly see in polling and in my anecdotal evidence and in my qualitative research that it is no longer, you know, it actually is now not cool to be considered to call yourself a Democrat on most, in most circles of young people, definitely online. And there really has been a shift in that Overton window in terms of where the trends and culture is going in terms of which party is more quote unquote cool. I think, you know, part of this is counterculture. So I've heard from a bunch of, this is again, young men who are the ones who are most commonly saying this, where when Biden was in office over those 4 years, if you wanted to be anti-authority, that meant supporting Trump or being more in the MAGA movement. And there's a distinction that I want to point out is that these modern day MAGA movement young people are not necessarily conservative. They're certainly not ruby red Republicans, but they feel they're a part of the MAGA movement. And that was part of the sort of counterculture as they describe it. And then you also asked about this sort of walking on eggshells type culture where, you know, people felt like they couldn't say their true beliefs out of fear of being ostracized, cast aside for having more conservative or Republican beliefs, or even just supporting President Trump. And that definitely has shifted. I mean, look at all the influencers, content creators, athletes, you name it, who have come out in support of President Trump. And, you know, we're seeing this in Silicon Valley too. I think that's been a large part of it. And one thing that stood out to me in my conversations ahead of the election was that a lot of the reason why young people told me they were excited to vote for President Trump was because they wanted to push back against this political correctness and this idea that you could be policed for saying just what you felt. And so a lot of the people I found who did vote for Trump, who are under 30, did so in part because they were just sick and tired of cancel culture and political correctness.
And so can you just put it in numbers for us? Kamala Harris still won the Gen Z vote, but by less of a margin than Biden did in 2020. So do you have, are there hard numbers on this?
Yes, there are. So if we look, we're relying on exit polling. So that's important to note, given that we haven't gotten the full voter file data back yet. But if you look at the data, so CIRCLE, which is the Center for Information on and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts, they are a database of youth vote data. And they found that of young voters under 30, so 18 to 29, 51% supported Kamala Harris in the 2024 election, and 47% supported Donald Trump. And so that's a huge shift from 2020, when it was estimated that 61% of young people voted for Biden and 37% voted for Trump. So, you know, the margin has just totally changed. And yes, Harris did still win the youth vote, but that is a shocking movement to the right for that cohort.
Totally. And you mentioned gender earlier. Can you just talk about the breakdown qualitatively when it comes to men and women in this cohort and how they are thinking politically?
Yeah. So the gender gap in terms of how young people are thinking about politics is massive. I've seen this in my qualitative data, which I'll talk about in a minute. But if you look at the way that CIRCLE's data shows how young people voted by gender in the 2024 election, 58% of young women supported Vice President Kamala Harris, and 56% of young men supported President Donald Trump. So that's the quantitative. But qualitatively, I mean, again, have been most shocked in how I've seen this playing out for high school students. And it really does seem that this is very present in campus culture. And when I talk to young women and young men about where the gender gap is stemming from, it's twofold. First, especially around the election, there was a lot of talk about reproductive healthcare access, and that was a huge issue for young women, but young men didn't see it as a forefront issue in the same way that young women did. That didn't mean that these young men were anti-abortion access. In fact, I've spoken with many young men who are pro-choice who voted for President Trump. They just didn't feel that the issue was the motivating issue getting them to vote in the same way that young women did. And a lot of the young women I spoke to said that it really did feel for them like their bodies and their rights and their futures were on the line in this election. So I think, you know, when you look at the issues, that's top of mind. But then moving beyond that, something that I've heard from a ton of young men, and I mentioned this before, is this idea of political correctness and this idea that Democrats were policing language, telling people what they could and could not say, had not really spoken to young men or made a concerted effort to bring them into their coalition. We saw towards the end of the election that, you know, Tim Walz was doing some stuff with football, and there was more of an effort to bring sports and have governors across the country talk about sports, which I actually think is a good strategy, but it didn't resonate and it was a little bit too late. And meanwhile, Trump was doing his podcast tour, traversing all of these male-dominated podcasts, just showing him who he is, himself, authentically, talking about things that weren't political, like, you know, his kids when they were growing up or sports. And that resonated with young men. He definitely made an effort to reach out to them, to bring them into his coalition, and it paid off. And I think young people are seeing that in their algorithms. So something that also comes up when I ask people about the gender gap and where they think this is stemming from, they recognize it, they feel it's very real. And they say, well, you know, part of the reason why young men and young women think so differently is because our social media feeds look entirely different. And if you look at a young man's feed, you'll see, you know, mostly male content creators who are spewing talking points about, you know, some of those sort of more male coded things like sports or working out or even dating tips. And then if you look at young women social media feeds, and I certainly see this in my own social media feed, it is content that's geared towards women. It's more about fashion, lifestyle, beauty, get ready with me videos. There's a lot of talk about food on there, and you know, there's the whole conversation we could have about that, but there's just very different content that's being fed to young men and young women. And the voices who are responsible for that content are shaping their beliefs, not just when it comes to politics, but culture writ large.
And Gen Z 2.0 is the first generation to have TikTok as a news platform, right? And so you can't ignore the power of TikTok in this conversation. How has TikTok evolved as a place where people get their news?
Totally. I think it's really important. I pointed this out in my op-ed for the Washington Post, but one of the, you know, in 2020, so TikTok really took off in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. It became the public square, not just for lifestyle content. At the time, we were, you know, all talking about making sourdough and tie-dye and things like that at the start of the pandemic, dancing videos, but it also became the public square for political conversations. And it now is a place for both. And the reality is that for older Gen Zers, when they were in middle school and high school, TikTok wasn't a thing. Like, we didn't have that. So now, if you're in Gen Z 2.0, you grew up with TikTok. And I think it's underrated just how much this really has transformed the way that we consume content. Certainly, vertical video was a thing prior to TikTok, but TikTok really made vertical video the way that we consume content. And now all of the other social media platforms have adopted or created their own versions of vertical video formats. And, you know, when it comes to the way that young people are consuming content and information, that vertical video content on TikTok and the length of those clips, it has changed the attention spans of young people. And the way that we flip through the For You page and get our content through that algorithm has changed the attention span of young people. I've had young people tell me that they don't have the the attention or the want to read through a full story. They rather just scroll through clips. I think that's been pretty well documented at this point. But the way that the political conversation is unfolding on that platform as well is markedly different than other platforms. It's much more raw. And TikTok has kind of flipped the idea of that social media is really polished and really filtered, and that you know, you can kind of present this version of your life. TikTok has in a way flipped that on its head, because the type of content that performs best on the platform is the more authentic, off the cuff, really quick quips. And that certainly has changed political content creation, but it's just changed content creation and consumption in general. So I think that's a large part of it. And then again, the algorithm is so smart that it feeds different people different content, and certainly contributed, I believe, to the gender gap as well.
So which politicians are doing a good job when it comes to speaking to Gen Z? You know, a lot of people talk about Kamala Harris should have gone on Joe Rogan, but even if she did, you know, I think people might have criticized her for feeling inauthentic, which is a big turnoff for Gen Z and turnoff for people in general, for voters. And I think of the Democratic senators all producing the same kind of cringy video a few weeks ago as a response to Donald Trump. Who are the politicians that are doing it right, and why?
Yeah, so I wrote about that Democratic Senate video, which was this sort of form template video they all, not all, but a lot put out. And the problem with that was that people could read right through it. It felt very staged. It felt very performative. And what young people really want is authentic content. So one of the politicians who I think is doing the best job at this is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She has been going live on Instagram since really for a while, but let's just say since the start of this administration. And she'll break down what is happening in DC, not with political jargon, not using language that's hard for people to understand, but just in everyday terms, sort of peeling the curtain back and telling Americans across the country what is going on Capitol Hill and in DC with this administration and how it affects their lives. And one of the things that I think is most interesting about this is that obviously AOC is someone who is very polarizing. People love her, people really don't like her, and there's everyone in between. I have noticed in the comment sections of she posts these live videos after she does them to her feed. And I've noticed in the comment sections that there are people who say, hey, I actually used to have a really bad perception of you, but after watching you do this, tell me what's going on the day to day in DC, and, you know, just explain things in normal language that everyday people can understand, I have a much better appreciation for what you're doing and a much better perception of you as a politician. So I find that really interesting. Now we're seeing she's also doing this tour across the country with Senator Bernie Sanders. And of course, that's an in-person rally and that's not on social media, but these rallies are being recorded and clipped for social media and shared with so many more people, especially young people, as a result. So I wonder if that's a strategy that we're going to start to see other Democrats emulate. I expect we will. Another politician that is doing a good job on social media is Ro Khanna. He has been doing these breaking news updates on TikTok that have gone pretty viral. And Ruben Gallego has been posting videos both in Spanish and English, which is interesting. I think that that's something that people appreciate. And then, you know, the other thing that I've been saying is that you mentioned that if Kamala Harris had gone on Joe Rogan, it would have been criticized, or, you know, maybe some people would have said it was a great thing that she went on Joe Rogan. And of course, you're never going to please everybody. But the thing that I think politicians, and it really doesn't matter what party they are, can start to practice more is that there's really a podcast or a creator or a show to go on for everyone. You just have to find the space that resonates most with what you have in common with. So for example, if there's a member of Congress who's really into fishing, they should go on fishing podcasts. If there's a member of Congress who's really into cooking, they should go on the cooking shows. We've seen Representative Sarah Jacobs, who's a young woman. She is really into beauty, and she started creating these get ready with me videos because that's something that's organic to her. It's relatable. Like, it doesn't seem weird necessarily to see her making these get ready with me videos where she's breaking down what's going on in Congress while doing her makeup. That's something that young women are used to seeing on their feeds, and she's doing that because it's relatable for her. So I think we'll start to see more of that type of content. It's not rocket science. It really is just being true to oneself and allowing that to show through on camera.
Totally. Being real, being like a normal human being, being authentic. As we wrap this conversation up, I'm curious about how Gen Z 2.0 feels about activism. I remember when we were in college, it felt like young people were leading the resistance. Today, the resistance feels like it's federal judges, if it's anyone. Do you expect that we'll see more protests from young people, or no, this is going to be the way it is for the next few years?
The Gen Z 2.0 has a very different relationship to activism than Gen Z 1.0. You know, Gen Z 1.0 was really applauded for being on the forefront of these social movements that were part of the resistance to the Trump 1.0 era. I think we've certainly seen campus activism around the Israel-Hamas war, and, you know, that was led by members of Gen Z 2.0. But something that is really important is that the way that these school administrations actually have cracked down on campus demonstrations, and you could say that that's in part because of President Trump, that's going to change their relationship to activism in general. I think the other piece of this is that it's just not as much in vogue as it was. And this has nothing to do with whether you're on a campus or not. And there's certainly a large portion of young people in this country who do not go to college and are not part of that campus culture. But demonstrating for these sort of social causes that were very part of the zeitgeist for Gen Z 1.0, it's just not a thing in the way that it was. And you're not seeing the performative social media activism as much either. I don't know exactly why that is. I think part of it has to do with the level of exhaustion and sort of feeling like a lot of this activism was pretty performative. I think people feel like, and I've certainly heard this in my listening sessions with young people, it's like they read through the fact that posting, let's say, a specific image on social media or an infographic doesn't actually lead to the change. And I think part of this, especially if you're looking from the perspective of very left-leaning young people, they look at the way that Gen Z 1.0 led these movements for these causes, and then they see that that didn't really get them very far and that President Trump is in office again. And so there's sort of less of an incentive to be a part of these movements if it put Trump back in the White House.
And last question, the Gen Z 1.0, 2.0 divide, is this a temporary shift or is this the way forward?
You know, I think there are certain elements of how Gen Z 2.0 views the world that will stick with them for the rest of their lives, given that they were so young at the time of the pandemic, and this anti-authority sentiment probably is pretty ingrained in them. That said, I don't necessarily think it means that Gen Z on the whole is going to be right-leaning for the rest of time. I think that in my conversations with young people, there are a lot of ideas that are raised or policies that they say they appreciate or are looking for that kind of meet in the middle almost, where you'll have both really left-leaning young people and really right-leaning young people talking about economic populism and the idea of breaking down the status quo and having this anti-establishment ethos. So I think that is sort of the uniting piece that brings Gen Z 2.0 from the left and the right together. I think it also brings Gen Z 1.0 and Gen Z 2.0 together too. And I wonder, you know, moving forward, how that will shape Gen Z's politics. And if this generation is disaffected, but not disillusioned, and many are not fully tuning out, they want to be a part of the solution, even if they have different ideas for what that solution is. They also are prioritizing free speech and want to have conversations with people from the other side of the aisle. So I don't necessarily think that these behaviors or these voting patterns are set in stone, but I do think that this anti-authority, breaking down the status quo in order to build something new idea will stick.
Well, Rachel Janfaza, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope that you come back.
Thanks, Andrew, for having me.
Thank you for watching and listening to The Golden Age. If you have any comments, please drop us a line at goldenage@politicon.com. Stay tuned for more episodes every week. You can watch us on Politicon's YouTube channel or subscribe to The Golden Age with Andrew Zucker podcast wherever you listen. I can't wait to see you next week.